Yeah, I found getting a park today just as hard as it was 20 years ago when I was here. It is actually 20 years. We moved back to Hobart in February of this year, which is 20 years to the month after I first moved down here as a pretty green, naive 18-year-old. Left home, the big smoke, came down here. You know, Launceston to Hobart's a pretty big journey, or at least it did feel like that to me. And yeah, I studied, did 5 years, five and a bit years here in an arts law degree. I only got a couple of SUPs on the way through, which was pretty good. I thought most of my engineering friends were doing extra years rather than extra exams. And then it was funny because while I was here, I actually went to St. John's Presbyterian Church and I'd sneak in the back. Normally I'd wear a tie. And I'd sit at the back and listen to what was going on, and gradually over time, hearing the preaching that was going on there, becoming very good friends with a couple of the older guys, reading some books, it began to dawn on me that there was more to life than what I thought, and there was more to Jesus than what I had originally thought as well. So that was a gradual process. Went back to Launceston. You know, working in a firm in Launceston is a bit like Hobart, except smaller. You've got to be sort of a jack of all trades, but master at none. So I ended up doing some conveyancing and some wills for a few months and thought that was awful. So I decided I wanted to become a barrister, you know. I wanted to get the wig on and go to court and get dressed up and do that silly stuff. So for about 7 years in Launceston, I ended up practicing law in anything that went to any of the courts in Launceston. So I predominantly did criminal defence work, acting for men and women and who'd been charged with crimes. But I also did work with for people who had been injured at work or who'd had car crashes. I did some boundary fence disputes between neighbours who were having silly arguments about how high fences should be, and I made a couple of people bankrupt. I wound up some companies. I did a lot of family law as well. I also did some Dog Control Act law, and a couple of times I got a magistrate to make an order that the dog be shot. They still pass the death penalty in the courts in Launceston. But then, as Mikey said, at the end of 2004, I resigned, not because of any deficiency I felt in the law. I think law is a very good thing to do. I think we need more Christians in law. I had no ethical dilemma, no problems with being a lawyer. I never once felt that my faith was being compromised, but I felt that there was something better that I could do with my time. So I went off to Sydney, studied, come back, and now, as I said, 20 years to the month, I'm back in the church, really where it all started, and I feel a bit strange being sort of, you know, the senior minister. When last time I was there, I was just some hungover bloke sitting up the back. So today, what am I going to do? Well, I want to weave together those two lives, I guess, if you like, those two careers, I suppose you want to call it that, my time in the law and now what I'm doing. And I want to talk to you about two miscarriages of justice. One of those miscarriages of justice was very much to do with my old career. The other miscarriage of justice is tied up with the stuff that I'm doing now. And I'll explain to you as I go along that I was involved in both of those miscarriages of justice, but in different ways. So I want to talk about these. I want to talk about two miscarriages of justice, and then in the middle, I just want to have a bit of a general ramble about justice. This is a law lecture theatre. It wouldn't be right of me to come in here and not ramble. So I'm going to do a bit of rambling, a little bit of sort of, you know, to-ing and fro-ing, and then after I've spoken about justice and why justice matters, I'll go on to tell you about the second miscarriage. So firstly, the first miscarriage of justice. It involved a man who at 1 o'clock in the morning got into his car in Launceston and drove for an hour, 50 kilometres, to another small town, and he arrived there at 2 o'clock in the morning. He knocked on the door of the house that he was driving to, and he was met at the door by the occupant, the man of the house, who let him in. The men knew each other. They'd known each other for some time. They began talking. The talking became arguing. The arguing became shouting. And then it turned violent. And before you knew it, the man of the house was lying on the lounge room floor in his own house, and my client was standing over him with a cricket bat and was bashing him with this cricket bat. Bashed him to the point of unconsciousness. Meanwhile, The victim's wife had woken up, as had the two children, and they were standing in the hallway watching this event happen in their own house. So, my client left after the man had been knocked unconscious. The police were called, so were the ambulance, and I was instructed to appear on behalf of the accused, who was charged with a serious offence, serious crime, in the Supreme Court at Launceston. And I took instructions and acted for him at his trial. The victim gave evidence at the trial. The trial started at 10 o'clock in the morning. The victim gave evidence at the trial. I cross-examined him. It was obvious to me that he was exaggerating in the evidence that he was giving, and fair enough, I guess. Awful things happen to us, and it's only natural that we would exaggerate. But, you know, this was a court, and I could zero in on his exaggerations, and sometimes our exaggerations can come across as mistruths. And so I cross-examined him about that, and it was obvious that he was exaggerating. His wife gave evidence about what she'd seen from the hallway with her children. In tears, she explained what she'd seen. She explained the cricket bat. She explained how her husband was knocked unconscious. She explained about how my client left, how she called the police and the ambulance. She explained that all this was going on in front of her children. Again, I cross-examined her gently. But she came across as a woman who was pretty bitter and hateful. And again, why you wouldn't blame her, having seen what she had seen. She came across as being bitter and hateful. It turns out from her evidence that the two men had known each other for a while and in fact didn't like each other. And I again was able to uncover some things in her evidence which made it look less perhaps than what she had intended it to. The doctor gave evidence and he said that he'd examined the victim and they were very serious injuries. A policeman tendered photographs that had been taken of the victim, and the case was over by lunchtime. At least all the evidence was heard by lunchtime. My client gave evidence just after lunch. He didn't have to give evidence, but I said to him, look, buddy, you know, you're going to have to explain why you were there and what you were doing, if there's any chance of this going well for you. So he did that. He actually came across as being pretty believable. He said he was acting in self-defence, that the other guy had started it. It's the usual story, isn't it? The other guy had started it, but he couldn't explain why he drove there, which I thought was a pretty crucial mistake. He wasn't able to tell, you know, when he was asked by the prosecutor, why were you there, he couldn't really give an answer. And neither could he explain why he felt the necessity of picking up a cricket bat and knocking this bloke unconscious. I addressed the jury, the prosecutor addressed the jury, the judge summed up by afternoon tea time. The jury were out, they'd taken the photos with them, they had before them on the table the evidence, really, about what had gone on. I went back into the roving room. You know, barristers go back and you pull out the Age or the Sydney Morning Herald and you read about the football or something, and I was settling in for a bit of a rest, and within 10 minutes there was a knock on the door, and the orderly from the court had come and said there's a verdict. It's the shortest time I've ever had to wait. And we went back in again, and the court was assembled, the judge came back in, the foreman stood up and it was unanimous, not guilty. And I couldn't believe it, but I guess that no one was more surprised than the accused. From the back of the court, I could hear cheering, and I looked around, it was the family of the accused cheering the result. But as I looked further around, I saw that sitting opposite them was the victim and his wife, and they were hugging and they were in tears, and they were going to have to go back and tell their children what had just happened. Within 5 minutes, the courtroom was empty. Everyone had gone. The judge moved on to something else, except I was just left sitting there, if you like. I was sort of just, you know, I couldn't really believe what had happened. I'd taken my wig off, and I was just sitting there feeling something that was troubling me. And I guess what it was that I sensed within myself that justice hadn't been done, that there had been a miscarriage of justice. In the face of what I thought was overwhelming evidence of my client's guilt, he was found not guilty. He was acquitted of the charge. Now, there's nothing unethical about my involvement in the case, so I didn't have to beat myself up about the way that I'd gone. I hadn't put words in this guy's mouth. I hadn't behaved in an unethical manner. I had a clear conscience about my own involvement in the trial. The prosecutor hadn't had a great day, to be fair, but, you know, we all have off days. But I thought she'd done enough. I thought that my client was condemned on his own evidence. but the jury formed a different view. And so my client was released back into society. Society were then going to have to cope with this man back in their midst. And a poor, humiliated father was going to have to go home and explain to his kids what had happened. Justice hadn't been done, I felt. There'd been a miscarriage that day, and I was sitting alone in the Supreme Court. I had a clear conscience, but an uneasy feeling. Deep down, you see, I sensed that what had happened wasn't right. And the question that I'm wanting us to think about today is this: why would I have had that uneasy feeling? Why did I feel that it just wasn't right what had happened? Now, I'm actually convinced that our criminal justice system is the best criminal justice system in the world. A trial by jury is the fairest way for a case to be tried. It's not perfect, but that's because the people who are involved in the criminal justice system aren't perfect. Sometimes liars look and sound like honest people, and sometimes the most honest person can look and sound like a liar. So it's not perfect. And if I'm pushed into a corner, I would probably say that if a jury were going to err on one side or the other, I would be more happy with them erring on the side that they went on this case. I'd be more happy that they would let a guilty person go than that they err on the other side and have an innocent person locked up. Now, there's an old saying in the law that it's better that 100 guilty men go free than one innocent man be condemned. It's better that 100 guilty men go free than that one innocent man be condemned. And I think, you know, if I were pushed into a corner, I'd probably say, yes, that's right. I think that's right. So I have no problem ethically or ideologically or theologically. You know, some people say to me, oh, how can you be a Christian and be a lawyer? I have no difficulty. I can answer that question very easily. I have no problem with the criminal justice system. I have no problem in the way I'd run that case, but I still felt uncomfortable. I felt uneasy about what had happened. And I know you know what I mean. You know what I'm talking about. You know what I mean when I say that miscarriages of justice, when we see them occurring, they get us in our guts, don't they? They get us deep down. When we see injustice, we feel it. And so I want to know why. Why do we? I want to explore that question. This is the drone part of this talk. You know, why? Why do we feel that? What is it about justice that gets us in our guts? Why does justice matter? Well, I've been reading a book by Julian Burnside. I don't know if that's a name familiar to you. Julian Burnside is probably at the moment the most popular human rights lawyer in our country. He does a lot of work for the so-called illegal immigrants, for the refugees. He's been a thorn in the side of what was the Liberal government, and I think he's now being a thorn in the side of the Labor government as well when it comes to the way that Australia treats refugees. They're not illegal immigrants. He would say they are genuine refugees, and I have a lot of sympathy for that, and I think good on Julian Burnside. So he's written a book, and he's called it Watching Brief: Reflections on Human Rights, Law and Justice. He is a man who thinks deeply about justice, and he thinks deeply that justice matters. Have a listen to what he says in his book. He says this: a fair go for all is probably as close as we get in Australia to a shared core value. Fair go. It's probably right, isn't it? In addition, a fair go is a minimum requirement for, or perhaps a natural product of, a just society. Fairness is an indispensable element of justice. In principle, he says, a just society is one where, at the very least, everyone gets a fair go. And I think we'd all agree with that, wouldn't we? And the reason I felt uneasy, you see, after that trial was because deep down I felt as though the victim, the person I had actually cross-examined, hadn't got a fair go. You see, not everyone can come into a court and sit in a witness box and have a judge sitting up here and a jury over here and then the accused sitting opposite. Not everyone can get in a witness box and tell their story in a way that sounds believable. It's asking a lot, I think, of a victim to do that. That's why now, in rape cases, victims can give evidence by video link from a room on their own. And it's a very good decision to have made, I think. Back in the old days, when a complainant of rape wanted to, there was a lineup of potential, you know, the lineups you see on TV. Well, back in the old days, the complainant was taken into a room where the men were lined up, and then she would have to go and touch the person that she said had done it. That's just intrinsically unfair. And it's no wonder that so many cases never made it to court. So I think to ask anyone who is a victim of anything to come into court and in a combative way give evidence is unfair, for some at least. And for the man who I was cross-examining, this unsophisticated man, it was beyond him. It was out of his comfort zone. He just couldn't come up with an answer that the jury would believe. In principle, Burnside said, in principle, a just society is one where at the very least everyone gets a fair go. And we'd all agree with that. You know, we would, wouldn't we? Regardless of a person's race or religion or social status or their educational achievements or the city in which they live or their sex or the language they speak or how able-bodied they are or what age they are. You and I would agree, I hope, we would agree that everyone has the right to be treated at the same level of fairness. There's a level playing field. That's what justice looks like. And that's why justice matters. Jeffrey Robertson's another lawyer, another one. I mean, you know, these guys that publish books tend to be sort of, you know, the guys with the big egos. Well, Jeffrey Robertson has an ego the size of Mars. And he's the guy who you might know because he recently actually headed up the legal team that represented Julian Assange. Well, in 1999, he wrote a book that was published that was called The Justice Game. And this is what he says in his book. This book, he says, is an attempt to explain why justice matters. It matters because we have an elemental need for reassurance that there is some chance of winning a legal contest against the powers that be. Most of us, he says, most of us will never find ourselves accused of crimes we did not commit, or oppressed by Whitehall, or by the most mighty in the land, or wish to publish something so shocking that public opinion will want to string us up. What we need to feel is that should this, heaven forbid, ever happen, we can turn to a legal system which will give us a reasonable chance of victory, preferably not posthumously. So Jeffrey Robertson and Julian Burnside agree, don't they? Justice matters. Everyone has a right to a fair go. I remember once coming back to, when I was in Launceston working as a lawyer, I was coming back to my office. I'd been out somewhere. And standing outside the doors to the building that I was working in were two plainclothes detectives. I knew them both. They knew me. You don't, you know, you sort of, Launceston's pretty small, so these were two I weren't related to. And as I went to go into the building, one of them approached me and they were waiting for me. And one of them stepped forward and he said, "Are you Alistair Bain?" And I said, "Yes." And then he put his hand on my arm and he said, "Mr. Bain, I'm here to tell you that you're under arrest." And I think all of the muscles below my waist collapsed at that point. And my heart stopped. And then he paused for a moment, still with his hand on my arm. He says, "I'm only kidding. I want to buy a house. Is there any chance that maybe I could come and see you about you helping us with the paperwork?" Anyway. Now, I couldn't help him, thankfully. I got out of conveyancing. Now, at that moment, I felt like someone who was being set up. I felt like someone who was potentially going to be the victim of some sort of miscarriage of justice. And for a moment, I was hoping like crazy that the criminal justice system that I was a part of would at least give me a reasonable chance of victory for this charge that had obviously been made up. It was a pretty awful thing to do, wasn't it? Justice matters. Miscarriages of justice are wrong. We long, don't we, for a world where justice prevails. It's right for us to dream about a world like that. We allow ourselves to be moved, don't we, by the great speeches of the world, by the Martin Luther King Juniors. We want to live in a society, what did he say, where justice flows down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream. We want to live in a society like that, don't we? And we want everyone else to live there with us as well, on every continent. We don't believe that justice is just some cultural construct that we have developed here, do we? We don't believe that. when I was here at the law school, I remember being set an essay question. I think it was an advanced crim or something. And the essay question was asking me to write about whether the West should be stepping in to rescue young African girls from female genital mutilation. Should we, as a society in the West, be stepping in to another culture in another continent, and should we be condemning a society that does that and rescuing those girls? And stupidly, I argued that we should leave them. I argued that justice was a cultural construct, and that actually it would be wrong for us to do that. And I hope immediately you are thinking less of me. And fair enough, if you are, I think less of me. The lecturer thought less of me. I'm embarrassed now that I wrote that essay. Because all of us, I think, we would agree, wouldn't we, that justice isn't culturally relative. It's not a cultural construct. We would say there is a universal right to be treated with dignity, wouldn't we? We want everyone to have access to justice and everyone to be given a fair go. Genocide is wrong in any country and in any culture. Child abuse is wrong. Torture is wrong. Fraud is wrong. Slavery is wrong. In Somalia at the moment, millions of people are dying from starvation. And the leaders of that country are actively preventing the West from bringing in aid so that the people in that country can be fed and given water. Well, we want to condemn that sort of behaviour, don't we? We would say that that is wrong. We might even use the word evil. But why? Why do we use that language? Where does that deep feeling of injustice, of anger at injustice, come from? Why do we have that? Well, the answer that I want to give to you today, and it's one that I want you to think hard about, the answer I want to give to you today is because we've been made that way. Justice matters because part of what it means to be human is to have an inner desire to see justice done. That's what it means, part of what it means for us to be human. And not just for us, but for others as well. We have an inbuilt concept of fairness. Julian Burnside again, he writes this: I share with Tom Stoppard. Now, Tom Stoppard is a British playwright. He's one of the guys who wrote Shakespeare in Love. So Julian Burnside says, I share with Tom Stoppard the view that we are all born with an instinct for justice. In Professional Foul, one of Stoppard's characters tells of the child who cries, "It's not fair," in the playground, and thus gives voice to an impulse which precedes utterance. An impulse which precedes utterance. Stoppard and Burnside would argue, and I would agree with them, that we are born with an instinct for justice. We feel it before we say it. There's an impulse which precedes the utterance. It's part of who we are, Burnside's saying. And I think he's right. I think he's right. I think you'd agree with him. Every human on the planet has this impulse which precedes utterance. Every person in every culture. Now, I was unsure about this on Monday of this week. My concern was I was going to come down here and talk to you about justice, and I'd speak about a global view of justice, but all I'd be doing actually was projecting on the whole world my own private school upbringing, educated, sort of, you know, British way of thinking about things. But I was having lunch with a friend of mine on Monday who's a UN lawyer. She's worked all over the world. Most particularly, she spent time in the Middle East, but she's currently doing some work amongst Muslims in Indonesia. And I was just talking out loud. She's not a Christian that I know of. I was thinking out loud about some of this stuff and just asking the question about why justice. And she's a UN lawyer, probably feels more strongly about justice than I do. And I said to her, well, I was worried that I would come along and speak to these students today and I would say these things which really are just my own view and I'm sort of projecting it out there. But then she told me about some research that she'd done recently on an island in the Pacific. And in her words, she says she went to this island and it was untouched. She says that this island really, you found the people living in the society on this island. Her words were that they were just like the Aboriginals of Australia 300 years ago. There'd been no Western influence, there'd been no Western missionaries, there'd been no invasion of Western jurisprudence. They were, to all intents and purposes, just as God had made them, and there they were. And yet she said that as she spent time with them and as she got to know them, she realised that their concept of fairness and justice was just the same as hers and just the same as mine, particularly amongst those groups in that society that were struggling to have access to that justice. So it's not a cultural construct. I want to say that's another argument, that's another example, another piece of evidence for us to see that the whole of the world is made, all the people of the world are made like them. Well, why? Why are we like that? Why is justice a universal attribute? The answer is that that I hope at least you will dare to accept is that it's because we've been made in the image of God. Genesis 1, 26, then God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness. Let's make man like us. Well, what's God like? Well, we know from the Bible he has an instinct for justice, an inbuilt instinct for justice. Isaiah 61:8, for the word God speaking, for I, the Lord, love justice. Psalm 11, the Lord is righteous, he loves justice. Psalm 33, the Lord loves righteousness and justice. So if we've been created in his image, if we bear his imprint, however faintly, but if we bear his imprint, then we'll be people who will love justice as well. Well, that's a pretty abstract word, justice. What does it look like? How does God's idea of justice actually cash out in the world? Well, let me reel off some verses from the Old Testament, which give us a feel for God's instinct for justice. Exodus 23 verse 6, do not deny justice to your poor people in their lawsuit. I did a lot of work as a criminal defence lawyer for legal aid and for Aboriginal legal aid for the people in our society who couldn't afford a lawyer. Well, in God's view, that's the right thing to be doing. Do not deny justice to your poor people in their lawsuit. Deuteronomy 10:17, for the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality and accepts no bribes. God defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow and loves the alien, the refugee, giving him food and clothing. Deuteronomy 16:19, do not pervert justice or show partiality. Do not accept a bribe. For a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and twists the words of the righteous. Don't pervert justice or show partiality. God would say that it's right that Madam Justice is blind, that she favours neither one side or the other, that she's impartial, that she's impartial, that she can't be bought. God would say it's right. That's exactly right. Zechariah 7. And the word of the Lord came to Zechariah, this is what the Lord Almighty says, administer true justice, show mercy and compassion to one another. Do not oppress the widow or the fatherless, the alien, the refugee or the poor. In your hearts, do not think evil of each other. And last one, Proverbs 31:8, speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. This is the sort of idea that gets people into law school. Speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves, for the rights of those who are destitute. Now, I haven't finished reading Julian Burnside's book, but you know, some of that stuff could have come straight out of there. In the justice of God, the poor, the vulnerable, the marginalised, the weak, they are lifted up, and they are treated with dignity and honour and fairness and justice. and we read stuff like that from the Bible, and we find ourselves, at least publicly, nodding along. God's idea of justice sounds pretty good to us, we think. That's the sort of society I want to live in. Why does justice matter? Why do we long to see it? Because God has that longing in himself. And we have been created in his image. We recognize the stuff from the Bible that we read, because even in the smallest of ways, we recognize that in ourselves as well. But the problem, of course, is we don't live in a society like that, and we don't practice justice like that either. The instinct for justice that I've been talking about, I've been banging on about now for too long, that instinct of justice, doesn't it, becomes too easily twisted into an instinct for something else. Something darker, something more sinister, something that often looks like just a grab for raw power. And we want justice, but we only speak about justice for us. And we deny justice to those who aren't us. God's concept of justice is all about giving up our rights so that others can flourish. But speaking for myself at least, too often I'm someone who takes away other people's rights so that I can flourish. And God sees that in us. He sees that what in fact we are doing is setting up another system of justice. And we're stepping outside of his system of justice, and we're making up a completely new one for ourselves, and then that brings us into conflict with him. I remember once I was sitting in court in Launceston, and a man came to appear before the magistrate, and it turns out that he had about 24 parking tickets he hadn't paid. I got a parking ticket this morning while ducking in for a very quick coffee at Yellow Bernard, and I got talking to some friends and came out, and that coffee's going to cost me about $18. Now, it's very good coffee at Yellow Bernard, but it's not that good, let me tell you. So anyway, I was in court, and some bloke had about 24 of these parking tickets, and he was refusing to pay them. And the magistrate said, well, why? You know, this is about the 5th or 6th time that he was in front of court. He kept adjourning it so this bloke could think about what he was doing. He didn't need another adjournment. He said, I'm not going to pay them. He said, I don't answer to the law of this land. I answer to a completely different set of rules, he says. Rules that I don't even recognise. I don't even recognise this court. I don't recognise you as a magistrate. You have no authority over me. I'm totally different to this. Well, the magistrate didn't care, and he sentenced him to 21 days and said, "See how your parallel system of justice goes in there, big boy." You see what I mean? You cannot. We think that we can escape, but actually there's an overarching, bigger system of justice. God, you see, is a God of justice. Justice must be done. We can't step outside his system. We don't like the sound of that. It's a hard thing for us, perhaps, to come to terms with. We don't like to think we're answerable to a higher power, that there is a justice that we need to be submissive to. But the fact that we have this inbuilt sense of justice tells us that there are really absolute rights and wrong. We certainly speak about them as though there are. We behave as though there are. We feel as though there are. There is such a thing as right and wrong. There is such a thing as sin. There is such a thing as judgment. And that brings me to my second tale, the second miscarriage of justice. And it's the trial of Jesus. You see, from beginning to end, he was denied justice. The arrest was illegal. The authorities had paid someone off to betray him. An accomplice had been paid off to betray him. He was never told what crimes he had to answer. He was denied legal representation. The judge, at least in the first instance, was also the prosecutor. So he was denied any chance of a fair trial at all. The court sat in private and at night. false witnesses were deliberately rounded up to come into the court to give evidence against Jesus. And this, you know, this passing parade of false witnesses took the witness box, and even though there were so many of them, none of their evidence could stick. So the judge decided that the only way they're going to get this guy was to change mid-trial, if you like, change the charge from that of blasphemy to that of sedition. And they then sent him off to the Roman court. He was sent from the Jewish court to the Roman court. And Pontius Pilate was asked to condemn him, and he did. In spite of the fact that Pontius Pilate made a deliberate finding of fact that Jesus had nothing to answer for and that he was not guilty, he condemned him. And he sentenced him to death. And following that sentence, Jesus was subjected to the most demeaning treatment by the people. He was on death row, and yet he became like a prisoner. This was like the Abu Ghraib of Palestine that was going on. He was spat on, stripped, flogged, and eventually executed. So in the first miscarriage of justice I told you about, a man was found not guilty in spite of overwhelming evidence that he was guilty. And he walked out of court free. In this second miscarriage of justice that I've just spoken about, in spite of overwhelming evidence of his innocence, a man was found guilty and he was nailed to a cross and died. You know, Jesus was exactly the sort of client that Julian Burnside or Jeffrey Robertson would have flown halfway across the world to represent, and they would have made sure the cameras were there. Jesus was the victim of the most dreadful crime against humanity. His case was a miscarriage of justice. But see, the message of the Bible is that that miscarriage of justice, that crime against humanity, was actually the best thing that could have happened for you. And the best thing that could happen for me as well. Why? Because even though we are guilty of stepping outside God's justice system, even though we're guilty of making up our own, God chooses in his mercy to overlook that, and he chooses instead to punish Jesus. Remember I said at the beginning that I wanted to tell you about two stories of miscarriage of justice, and that I was involved in both of them? Well, I am involved in both of them, but if anything, I'm actually more personally involved in the second one. Because in that case, Jesus is taking the rap for me, and I'm allowed to go free. I was the lawyer in the first case. I'm the accused in the second. Christopher Hitchens calls this notion grotesque. How can it be good and just, he says. How can it be good? How can it be just? How can it be fair that an innocent person be punished for crimes he didn't commit? Fair question. Hitchens says, if God is behind this, if there is a God, and he doesn't believe there is, but if there were a God, and if God is behind this, then he is the perpetrator of a crime against humanity. And you know, I think he's got a point. I think Christopher Hitchens got a point about that. Why should a fellow human who's innocent of any wrongdoing be treated so awfully? Why should he cop the punishment for what I have done? Dr. Hitchens is right, isn't he, to say that? It's an awful concept, the one I've just described to you. God is a monster. Isn't that the description here we've got? That's what it looks like, doesn't it? That's what it looks like. But what if Jesus was God? And what if rather than staying at a distance, he enters into the world of injustice? And God himself, the very picture, the very personification of justice, chooses for us to become a victim of injustice. What if it's God who is going to the cross and absorbing the punishment that we should get? Well, I think that changes everything. I think that's a fatal blow for Dr. Hitchens. See, that isn't a picture of grotesque. That isn't something grotesque. That's something that's glorious and gracious. And that's a picture of justice that changes everything. I heard this morning I've got a few heroes of the faith, if you want to use that sort of language. One of them this morning I heard die, John Stott. It was reading a sentence in a book that he wrote probably 20 years ago that began to unlock for me the understanding of what I've just talked about to you. In his book called The Cross of Christ, I want to end with this paragraph. He says, this is John Stott. "I could never myself believe in God if it were not for the cross. In the real world of pain, how could one worship a God who is immune to it? I've entered many Buddhist temples in many different Asian countries and stood respectfully before the statue of the Buddha, his legs crossed, arms folded, eyes closed, the ghost of a smile playing round his mouth, a remote look on his face detached from the agonies of the world. But each time after a while I've had to turn away, and in imagination I've turned instead to that lonely, twisted, tortured figure on the cross, nails through hands and feet, back lacerated, limbs wrenched, brow bleeding from thorn pricks, mouth dry and intolerably thirsty, plunged in God-forsaken darkness. That is the God for me," says Stott. "He laid aside his immunity to pain. He entered our world of flesh and blood, tears and death. He suffered for us. That is the God for me," says John Stott. And I want to say to you that that is the God for you as well. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks, mate.
We actually have a moment for questions.
Okay.
And Al's very happy to take some. But just to give you a moment to collect your thoughts, to think if there are any questions or comments you'd like to give. We actually have a couple of collection buckets, and I'd love to, if you could do the courtesy of just even giving a brief response to how you found the session. So if there are any questions or comments you want to make publicly, you've got an opportunity to do so.
Yep. So God's choice to redeem us, right, was to take the punishment for us.
Mm-hmm.
But why are we so uninclined to accept that kind of in our world today? Like, if there was a murderer who killed 20 people, and then someone got up in court and said, I'll take the punishment for them, we would be appalled at that. How can we expect society to not be appalled at Jesus?
So that's the Christopher Hitchens line, isn't it? That this idea of someone taking the punishment for someone else is just grotesque.
And even if it is like God himself, how is that not
how's that a game changer?
Well, I guess it's because we a couple of reasons I think why the world is so disinclined to accept that. Firstly, I don't think we're very good at explaining it. So I think we ought to be taking some responsibility for that. We've made it about something else. We've made it about religion and doing good stuff, rather than realizing that there's no good stuff to be done. So that's the first point. The second point: why would the world not accept it? Well, firstly, I think because we just can't bear the fact that someone who's hurt us might get away with it, because we don't forgive them for it. There's a lack of forgiveness, perhaps, in the way we're thinking about someone, and people should have to pay for what they've done. But see, that's a little bit tricky, because if that's the case, then we should have to pay for what we've done as well. The second point is that the Bible says these things are only understood when God gives us understanding. We aren't people who have sought God in this. We haven't read the Bible. We haven't properly prayed and asked that God give us this gift. And so we end up sort of not understanding. We prefer our own thing. Is that what you're thinking? Tell me what's behind the question.
It just seemed like strange that, I guess, from a Christian perspective, honestly, to accept the idea that God can take our punishment when it's decided that that's such a...
Do you think maybe it's because people just don't feel, they don't understand the personal nature of the punishment that is waiting them? And if they understood the serious predicament that they were in, then they might be more likely to take the remedy that God has given. So if God in fact isn't going to punish anyone for injustice, then firstly he's not a God of justice, he's just lazy. You know, if a Supreme Court judge decides after hearing a case that he's just not going to hand down sentence, even though the person has pleaded guilty or been found guilty, then he'd be removed because he's not dispensing justice. So justice involves putting things right and punishing those things that need punishing. Maybe what people outside the church hear is either God is a God of, is an angry God who's going to punish, and then that's all they hear, so they run from that. Or, on the other hand, they don't actually hear that God is a punishing God, and so they don't have any reason to run from that.
Any other comments or questions? Well, I had just one additional comment on that, if I may, just as I'm chewing it up, because it is such a profound question, and it's at the heart of what we're doing. But perhaps one helpful in-between thing might be the thought of part of what goes on in the act of forgiveness of a crime done against you. If you think about it in terms of crime against property, part of the act of forgiveness is saying, well, in the end, I'm paying for my car to get repaired rather than forcing you to pay it for me. And so there is a choice on the behalf of someone who forgives to actually absorb the cost of the wrong that's done on some level. Mm. That might be a stepping stone, perhaps, as well towards an answer, that something of the act of God taking the penalty is absorbing something of the cost there or something. But yeah. Please use the cards to respond to us. Please come and join us in other things. But thanks again for taking your lunch and be with us here. And thank you so much, Al, for joining
us. Pleasure to be here. Thanks very much.
Thanks.